Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is recovering from a voice treatment, and she'll be back on the air tomorrow. President Obama is set to announce plans to freeze non-security-related federal spending for 3 years. He's pledged to reduce the federal deficit, but he also faces enormous pressure to help the millions of Americans struggling to find a job. And that could mean more spending. Here to discuss what could be the coming conflict between addressing joblessness and the national debt, Alice Rivlin of the Brookings Institution. She's a former vice chair of the Federal Reserve. Kevin Hassett of the American Enterprise Institute. And joining us by phone from Austin, Texas, James K. Galbraith. He's an economist and professor of government at the University of Texas School of Public Affairs. Well, welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Good morning.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. Our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Well, the front page of the morning papers are full of stories about a White House plan to free some federal spending. Alice Rivlin, you are founding director of the Congressional Budget Office. You've been director of the Office of Management and Budget. Is this freeze that was unveiled this morning in the papers, is it a serious effort to control the deficit, or is it mostly a symbolic one?
It's a good first step in the right direction, but it controls a very small part of the budget. The real problem with federal spending as we look ahead is not discretionary spending, which the Congress votes every year. It is Medicare, Medicaid, all of the entitlements that go on, whether the Congress votes them or not. So if he freezes discretionary spending, and it's only non-defense discretionary spending, it's about one-eighth of the budget. And that doesn't make a huge difference in controlling the deficit. But it's a statement that he thinks controlling the deficit is very important, and it is.
Kevin, how do you see it?
I agree with Alice that it's a good start. I think that it's also true that when you freeze something at the beginning of, say, a 10-year outlook, that it has a can have a pretty big effect. It's amazing what getting a head start on debt reduction can do for you. The concern I would have would be that maybe it's not timed precisely correctly. It could be that freezing things that soon is putting negative drag on the economy precisely when it's just starting to lift up. Make no mistake, unemployment's still very, very high.
James Galbraith, do you think this is a smart idea?
I think it's an ineffective step and in the wrong direction. So I'm not as troubled by it as I might otherwise be.
You're not troubled by it because you think it's ineffective.
Yeah, it doesn't amount to very much. And as the administration spokesman were saying on television last night, it's going to be offset by this, that, and the other thing. I do think, though, that the Republicans are to be completely congratulated at this point. They've turned a political event in Massachusetts into the impression of complete disarray at the White House as it tries to basically reconcile the irreconcilable, the attitude that people have instinctively toward spending and deficits, which the White House would like for people to believe they're going to reduce, and yet the condition of the economy, which still requires extraordinary efforts to get growth going again, to start restoring employment, and which simply cannot be done if you are preoccupied with the deficit, either in the short or the longer term. So it's they're in a very big box. The Republicans have put them there, and they haven't shown a very very quick wits about how to get out.
Alice Rivlin, do you see this as irreconcilable goals to address the deficit at a time you're also trying to get the economy going again?
They are difficult goals to reconcile, but I don't think it's impossible. I believe the American public is smart enough to recognize that right now we need more spending to get the economy moving. And over the next few years, as the economy recovers, and I believe it will, it's already beginning, we need drastic steps to rein in the deficits because they're on a track to sink us as an economy. Just too much borrowing. We couldn't borrow that much if we borrowed everything that is implied by the current projections of spending and revenues over the next 10 years.
Give our listeners a sense of how big the deficit is, how much the debt is growing.
Well, the debt is growing quite rapidly in the last few years. The best way to think about it is as a percent of everything we produce, as a percent of the gross domestic product. And it's gone up very fast from about 37% of the gross domestic product a couple of years ago to around 60%. And the scary thing is, on current projections, it's headed up rapidly. Now, what does that mean? That means that if we have to pay higher interest rates on this debt, it'll get very expensive to carry the debt service that we have to pay every year. It also means that because a lot of it is held by foreigners, the Chinese and others, that we're quite vulnerable to their ideas about what we should do.
James Galbraith, do you agree? Is this of great concern?
Now, let me challenge Alice's argument, because if it were true, and I think she believes that the financial markets assess these matters quite carefully, and if it were true that the United States was facing, even in the medium term, over 10 or 20 years, the great threat to its borrowing capacity that she mentions, then the financial markets would be charging the federal government today a substantial interest rate to take account of that risk. But they're not doing that. What is happening? The long-term rate, the 20-year federal government bond borrowing rate, is falling. It's fallen 20 basis points, actually, in the last couple of days. It's now below 4.4%. It's lower than it was before the Great Crisis. It's much lower than it was back in 1999 and 2000 when the federal budget was in surplus. So this is clearly not a correct analysis, at least as seen by the people to whom it matters, that is to say, by the people who lend to the federal government. And I think the correct analysis is that the federal debt is not, in fact, the dramatic issue that Dr. Rivlin makes it out to be, that the United States government will not face a problem funding itself to the extent necessary. And if we somehow did succeed through a policy of really effective programs to support both public and private investment and restore employment, then the economy would grow, and the proportion of the debt to the economy, which I agree with Alice, is in fact the thing you want to keep an eye on, would not grow as rapidly as projected because we'd have a larger economy. Ultimately, at the end of the day, these are issues which should not be preoccupying us the way they are. We have a massive unemployment problem, and we have vast challenges to rebuild the country. We have very badly neglected, decaying, and decrepit infrastructures. Anybody can see we have vast environmental and climate problems that are going to require real resources to deal with. We should be focused on those issues and not, as I say, scaring ourselves with the shadow of financial numbers, which are, we really can't make a consistent argument for the case that they're as threatening as people claim.
Well, Kevin Hassett, what do you think?
I think that there's something to both arguments, but I've recently done a study of past debt problems to start to try to get a handle on this. And there are some disturbing numbers, which are actually more disturbing than they should be if you really think about it. I mean, people want to buy U.S. Treasuries because the U.S. is the safe haven still. It was the safe haven during this crisis. But our external debt, the money that we owe to foreigners, is higher relative to our GDP. It's closing in on 100% than it has been for the typical Latin American country that defaulted on its government debt. We're up in a danger zone. But on the other hand, we're the place everybody wants to be. And so probably we'll be okay. But the history of these things is you don't see them coming, sort of like Lehman Brothers. What happens is it's not that we stop paying the interest payments. It's that on Monday we have to sell a lot of debt and nobody shows up at the auction because they're panicked. What might set off such a panic? Well, let's suppose that Greece or some other country defaults on its debt. Well, then you might start to see a real problem. And so I think it's important to get our house in order, but we'll probably be able to tread water for a good long time before it really bites us.
Let me just add to what Kevin said. The difference between the United States and Latin America is that the Latin American countries and other countries which have gotten into these debt difficulties in recent decades owed their debts in U.S. dollars, a currency that they had to earn by running export surpluses. We owe our debts in U.S. dollars, a currency that we do not have to earn by running export surpluses. We can never run short of them. So there is actually the burden on us of servicing our debt cannot be compared to the burden on Brazil or Argentina servicing a debt in dollars. And I agree with Kevin as well that to the extent that a financial crisis might occur, it will be precipitated by some political event which we cannot control, and it's basically not related to the fiscal measures that we are taking at home.
Mm-hmm.
If there were a war, for example, over the Taiwan Strait, which is an event I do not expect to happen, you might expect some disruption, a major disruption in our financial relations with China. But they're not going to do that because they're spooked by some estimate that comes out of the Office of Management. But
all right, Alice Rublin.
I profoundly disagree respectfully with Professor Galbraith. He has much more faith in the perspicacity of markets than I have. He is saying if this were a big problem, the long-run interest rate would be going up. I believe that the purchasers of our bonds believe we'll get on top of this problem, and they're willing to wait for that, but we have got to do that.
Alice Rublin is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and was director of the Office of Management and Budget and a founding director of the Congressional Budget Office. And we're also joined this hour by Kevin Hassett from the American Enterprise Institute and James K. Galbraith from the University of Texas. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the situation with jobs and whether government action could help reduce that 10% unemployment rate. And we'll take your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking about the President's State of the Union address tomorrow night and the proposals he'll make both to freeze federal spending on some discretionary programs, but also to help joblessness. And I wonder, Professor Galbraith, would you describe for us just very briefly, what's the situation now when it comes to unemployment in this country?
Well, we have a huge task ahead. In order to both reemploy those who have lost their jobs in the great crisis and to absorb the increase in population, we need about 250 to 300,000 jobs a month over the next 5 years. So we need a very long, sustained burst of job creation. I don't think we have the strategy in place to get that.
So, Kevin Hassett, do you think that this talk of a second stimulus package, congressional Democrats are talking about it, we may hear something from President Obama about it tomorrow night, could that help spur employment so some of the millions of Americans who lack jobs now could get them?
It could a little bit, but I've been pushing in columns and elsewhere a couple of ideas that I think are slightly different from what is likely to be proposed. I think that it's very important, for example, to change our unemployment insurance so that if a firm wants to lay some people off, we offer them an incentive not to do that, but rather maybe to reduce hours and to spread those reductions in hours off across a number of people. I think that there are a number of policies that we could take right now or adopt right now that would have a positive effect. And I'm worried about throwing more money through the stimulus like the one we had last year. If we had just hired people at the median U.S. wage, then the stimulus package last year would have created something like 21 million jobs. And it seems to me that it's a very indirect way to create jobs to be building a bridge that takes 3 years to plan or something like that. And I'd much rather have the government hire people directly and change the unemployment insurance rules. I think that'd be much more effective right now.
Alice Rivlin, do you think the stimulus package that was passed last year, the $787 billion one, do you think it's had the effect of making unemployment less bad than it would have been otherwise?
I do. I think it is a good deal less bad. It's a little hard to quantify how much less bad it is. But I agree with Kevin that infrastructure projects are not a particularly quick or effective way to create jobs. Some of the most effective things in the last stimulus were aid to the states to keep them from laying off people, keep them producing their services. I think we need to do more of that. And I think we can operate on the tax side on incentives to employment. Interesting idea in this morning's paper from two unlikely senators, Schumer and Hatch, proposing a change in the payroll tax, which would be more pro-employment.
When you look ahead, what do you think is going to happen with employment? Where will we be, do you think, say at the end of the year? James Galbraith, where do you think?
Approximately where we are now.
So 10%, that's really high.
Yes, it will be. And we may create some jobs between now and then, but people who have left the labor force will come back in. So it still looks to me like 10% unemployment unless we get some very dramatic steps. And I agree with what Alice just said and with what Kevin just said, at least as far as the kind of jobs we should be creating is concerned.
Kevin, do you also think Americans should be braced for 10% unemployment to the end, through this whole year?
I think that there are two competing views of our future that could both be true. One is the old Milton Friedman plucking model, that if the economy is like a violin string. If you pluck it farther down, it snaps back quicker. If we get a pluck back, then I could see the unemployment rate going down as far as 8 or so by the end of the year. But it's not necessarily the case that that's what's going to happen, because the history of financial crises, there's a new book out by Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff that I commend to every listener on financial crisis. I guess this time is different as the title. But in their book, they show that after a financial crisis, it tends to look pretty bad for a good long time. I think that fourth quarter GDP is looking like it might have increased at about 5 or 6%. And so we're starting to get some growth. That's pretty good growth. If we got, don't forget, back in the 80s, we had a year where the economy grew about 7% after a steep recession. That was the sort of pluck, the reverse pluck. If we got something like that, then it would be different. I'd say the odds of getting a happy growth experience where we have 6 or 7% growth this year, probably like 20%, something like
that. And yet, even when you have some growth, you often have unemployment continue at pretty high rates. Alice Rivlin, where do you think unemployment will be through this year?
Well, I'm hopeful it'll come under 10. I guess my guess would be somewhere in the nines. If we get to the high eights, that would be a very good performance because we've lost so many jobs and we've lost people from the labor force, as Professor Galbraith points out. And because consumers aren't rushing in to spend because they were overextended.
Yeah, tough year ahead for a lot of the unemployed. Let's talk briefly before we go to the phones about Ben Bernanke. He's been nominated for a second term. His first term, I think, expires at the end of this week. A lot of controversy on Capitol Hill and in the Senate that must vote to confirm him. James Galbraith, do you think that Ben Bernanke deserves a second term? Should the Senate confirm him?
I think it's in the better interest of the Federal Reserve that he not be confirmed and that the president appoint someone else. And the principle here is command responsibility. Bernanke is a very smart, very hardworking man, but he was in charge in the last few years before the crisis. And in many ways, he failed to foresee failed to act in a prudent and a skeptical way toward the dangers in the financial system. So I think the institution really would be better served by having having new leadership, and that would be capable of taking it in a new direction.
Kevin Hassett, do you think Ben Bernanke should be confirmed?
I'm closer to Professor Galbraith on this than I expected. I think that Ben's a very good person, and he had a very hard job, but that you in the end need to be accountable for your actions. I think that the Fed helped feed the problem, create the crisis by, one, not regulating harshly enough, and two, keeping interest rates very low and feeding the huge run-up in real estate prices. And, you know, someone needs to be held accountable for that. I also think that, that the people at the Fed are really exhausted right now, and that bringing in some fresh blood could re-energize a staff that's really been working 100-hour weeks for a couple of years now.
Alice Rivlin, command responsibility?
I think Ben Bernanke did a magnificent job once the crisis happened. I agree with both my colleagues that the Fed made many mistakes, the Fed and others, many mistakes before in the run-up to the crisis. It could have been avoided. But once it happened, he was a very strong leader and didn't lose his cool and took the right actions most of the time. I think he's earned another term, and that it would be very disruptive at the Fed. It would be seen as a slap at the Fed to replace him with somebody less experienced.
All right, let's go to the phones and let some of our listeners join our conversation. We'll go first to Pete. He's calling us from Walkersville, Maryland. Pete, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. A comment and two questions. First, let's have a little more faith, guys, because didn't Clinton leave Bush W a surplus? First question is, the commission that's being proposed by Judd Gregg and Conrad and Lieberman, isn't Pete Peterson behind that to actually get rid of Social Security and Medicare? And secondly, why can't we force the banks to pay people a decent interest rate on savings accounts? And I'll listen off the air.
All right, Pete, thank you. Let's talk first about your question about the commission. We're going to see a vote in the Senate today on a bipartisan commission to aimed at reducing the U.S. debt. How would that work, Kevin?
Well, I think that from our conversation, I hope everyone's gathered that people on the left and people on the right are really concerned about this debt. And, we're not so concerned that we think that we have to act precisely now while unemployment is 10, but we need to act. And I think that a commission is a good idea because it allows people to get into a room and work something out that makes sense. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a big immediate reduction in government spending right now or a big tax increase right now. You can change the trajectory of benefits and so on over the next 20, 30 years and restore the fiscal situation to a much better path. And so I think it's a good idea. And I also commend Alice, who had a press conference yesterday, for starting the debt reduction task force. I think that people like Alice, who have the respect of everyone in Washington, are going to be the resources that in the end to get us out of this mess.
Alice, you have been a leader of this proposal for a new bipartisan task force on debt reduction. But to talk about the Senate proposal, do you think it's going to pass today, this idea of a bipartisan commission?
I doubt it, because the Republican leadership has said that they're worried it would recommend some tax increases and therefore they won't vote for it. That's a very partisan position. I believe, as do Senators Conrad and Gregg, that we need to bring both parties together. A commission wouldn't be my favorite device, but I think we need one now to show that it can be done and that the parties can talk to each other. Because as Kevin says, once you get them on a commission with a mandate and an upper down vote, they have to talk about what they're going to do.
Well, bipartisan commissions on debt reduction are all the rage. We think we'll also hear a proposal for one from President Obama perhaps tomorrow night in the State of the Union. James Galbraith, are they a good idea?
No, they're not a good idea. I think the underlying agenda, and the caller was quite right, this idea has been backed for years by major interests emanating from Wall Street, Peter Peterson, his man David Walker, is to make it politically possible to cut Social Security, especially in Medicare. And there is no good economic case for cutting Social Security. Social Security is basically the income support for most of America's working elderly, and those who have other resources have had those resources hit very hard by the slump. The value of their housing is way off. They're not getting any interest income on their cash holdings, as the caller pointed out, and their stock holdings, to the extent they have any, fell dramatically in value. So Social Security bulk is much more important in the living standard of the elderly population of America than it did even a few years ago, and it should be protected rather than undermined. And I think the truth is that the reason there's pressure to do this in a commission, but basically behind closed doors, is that it would be much easier for Social Security's enemies to make progress against Social Security that way than by going through the regular channels of the Congress.
Well, Alice Riblin, you're supporting this idea of a bipartisan commission. Is cutting Social Security really the agenda here?
No, I don't think so. The agenda is to find a way to bring the spending and the revenue lines together. At the moment, as you look far ahead, as the population ages and as medical care costs rise, we will have spending under Medicare, Medicaid, and to a lesser extent Social Security that far exceeds the revenues that we'll have. So the question is, what do we do about that? We have to do something. And we need a group of people figuring out what we do.
Kevin Hassett.
I think that there are two things. First, there is a big literature that shows that when countries get their house in order, that it can have positive effects on the economy relatively quickly. The idea is, if you Google it, you can find some papers on this. There are non-Keynesian effects to fiscal consolidations, which means that basically right now maybe people are uncertain about how we're going to fix the mess, and that makes them wary of engaging in new activity, building a factory because you don't know if taxes are going up. And so I think we need to do it. And I think that even the economists on the show could probably work something out even on Social Security. And so I think that you know, I'd welcome the opportunity to sit in a room and try to work it out, because, you know, maybe we cut benefits for rich people, lift the cap on the tax rate a little bit so it goes a little farther up and you get some revenue and you restore balance. And so I think that there is a possibility of a big benefit from this.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to call us, call 1-800-433-8850. Find us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Well, I bipartisan commissions are popular in Washington, but I wonder, isn't this why we elect members of Congress and a president to work out these big issues, these big challenges facing the nation? I mean, isn't it their responsibility to wrestle with some of these issues, Alice Riblin?
Yes, but they're not doing it. I think a commission is a sort of desperation move. If the parties aren't talking to each other and getting the problems solved, then the question is there some device that will force them to talk to each other? And the people have come up with the idea of a commission.
Let's go to Billings, Montana, and talk to Rick. Rick, hi. Thanks for holding on.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So I originally had a four-point question to throw out to your panel, but after listening to the last few comments, I just would like to make a comment and have one question. I disagree and agree with your panel on several things. The first thing is that I don't see how, over 20, 30 years, we can't raise the taxes to help to go after this deficit. And the comment would be, why not a transparency commission to work this out? And we can't go after Social Security, because these people have built into this fund and they depend and survive on this. What we need to do is raise taxes, beef up that fund, take care of our elderly, and go from there. The only time you get ears raised is when you mention middle class. Well, where was the middle class in the last 8 years? You know, how did we get into this mess was my original question. And, you know, where were we then? You can't make you can't make this guy the fall guy for everything that's gone on. You know, there's a lot of people responsible and accountable. If he has to be the fall guy, we're just going to replace him with another fall guy. There's no way we can get by without taxes and, you know, transparency within our country to open the eyes and ears of the middle class.
All right, Rick, thanks so much for your call. James Galbraith, what would be the effect now of raising taxes or making a plan to raise taxes?
Well, you can plan all you want down the road, and the effect is essentially nil. The question is, what do you do today and in the very near future, and how do you bring the economy back to high employment? And let me just come back to a very basic premise of the conversation, which is that we should somehow be aiming toward a balance between revenues and spending in the federal government. The fact is, the country has been in existence since the early 1790s, and that balance has existed only on six very brief occasions, each of them followed by a major recession. The government always runs a deficit. The deficit is a normal condition. It is, I think, psychologically anomalous for us to not have adjusted to that in several centuries of existence as a republic. And the second reality, which is more recent, is that to the extent that we're supplying a reserve asset, U.S. Treasury bonds, to the world, we're going to need to run an even larger deficit in order to do that. So we should, as an accounting matter, we should cool off a little bit on this issue, try to understand where the U.S. is in the world, and then plan on the basis of that reality rather than constantly berating ourselves for not achieving a goal which, in fact, we cannot achieve.
James Galbraith, he's an economist and a professor of government at the University of Texas and author of The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. And I'm also joined in the studio by Kevin Hassett from the American Enterprise Institute. He's the director of economic policy studies there. And Alice Rivlin from the Brookings Institution. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go to the phones and take more of your calls and questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
The power of our hidden brains. How our unconscious minds help elect presidents, control markets, wage wars, and influence our daily lives. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Alice Rivlin, we heard James Galbraith make the case that deficits are a standard condition of government operation and not something that should cause a lot of concern. You wanted to respond.
Yes, I think that Professor Galbraith hasn't noticed what the projections for spending and revenues are. Since we've made promises to older people that are getting more expensive every year, if you look 10, 20 years down the road, we would be paying for those promises with more than we've ever collected for the entire federal government. We can't borrow that much money, and we can't raise taxes as much much as it would take to cover those promises. So we have to somehow, over time, slowly, figure out how we're going to scale back the promises. That doesn't mean cutting Social Security. No one would get less than they get now. It just wouldn't rise as fast, perhaps. We have to also get more revenue into the system. Otherwise, we can't borrow that much.
Let's talk to Lynn. She's calling us from Plano, Texas. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I was calling because many, many times when I listen to programs like this on NPR as well as other news outlets, it seems to me that the experts who are well-educated and perhaps have a lot of book knowledge, they seem to continuously ignore the fact that our basic markets within this country has been decimated over decades by moving the production of our most basic everyday products to other countries. I just did a quick inventory of my bathroom, all of my towels, my underwear, most of my clothing, even my soap was made in China, for instance. And when I think about it, as I grew up in the South, people could be almost guaranteed that when they were ready to go to work, if they didn't want to go to college, they could go work in the textile mills and make a very good living, and that was like a path to middle class. Well, when you say that things like, infrastructure projects take too long, 2 to 3 years to plan and build a bridge, I would just like for them to simply tell us, where will these jobs, these millions of jobs, where will they be coming from? It seems like we were so interested in getting the cheapest product possible, we cared nothing about, we basically ate our young from a job standpoint.
All right. Lynn, thanks so much for your call. Kevin, I think you made the comment about the delay in stimulus spending and the idea that building a bridge over 3 years wasn't the best way to go about it.
Yeah, I think that Lynn raises an important question about how to think about trade and all this, too. The first thing I can say is that I think the best idea right now is, again, to change the unemployment insurance program, because there's something that goes on in labor markets underneath it all that a lot of people might not recognize, and that is that there are a lot more jobs created and destroyed each month than the net number you see. So if you saw that we lost 100,000 jobs last month, we might have lost 100,000 jobs because, you know, 600,000 were destroyed and 500,000 were created, and on net we lost 100,000 jobs. And so if you could slow the job destruction by having a work-sharing program where employers get an incentive to not lay people off but rather spread hours reductions out across a number of workers, then the job creation that's already out there could potentially start to lead to a reduction in the unemployment rate. It's a kind of layup, I think, and it's something that we should do. With regard to trade, you know, I think that economists generally really like trade, because what we want to do is buy cheap goods and do the thing that we're best at. And so I think that if the Chinese are providing cheap products to us, then that makes us better. If people with low incomes go to Walmart and can buy things for a lower price, then that's good for their welfare. And I don't think that a trade barrier would improve anybody's welfare.
You know, we've gotten several emails from people on the issue of unemployment. Here's one from a listener in Northfield, Ohio. He writes, "My wife and I are both unemployed right now. It's hard enough to keep our personal finances straight, but if we did it like the Congress does it, we would have been ruined years ago. From our seat, the unemployed general public just sees chaos and a lost future. I do not believe the glowing projections they talk about, and the clock is still ticking for those of us who have been without jobs now for more than 8 months. They fiddle while Rome burns." And here's another one from Rick. He writes, "It's a slap in the face to the unemployed to rehire Ben Bernanke. His competence is immaterial. He should, as a leader, be held strictly liable for the failure. To do otherwise sends the wrong message to the unemployed who are struggling through no fault of their own." James Galbraith, going back to Lynn's question, where should Americans look to for good jobs that they could see on the horizon in the near-term future?
Well, I think Lynn's question underlines a major challenge. Whether you like trade or don't like it, the reality is we cannot stop the Chinese from doing what they want to do. And if they want to produce and flood the world with cheap manufactured goods, those goods are going to be available. I think that means that we have to create jobs in this country meeting the needs of the American people. And there are enormous needs. We have an aging population that needs a lot more care than it's getting, and it could use that care in much more comfortable settings than elderly people receive now. We have, as I said earlier, a vastly decrepit infrastructure, which could be rebuilt over a very long period of time. We have a huge energy and environmental challenge, and meeting that, some of that requires highly skilled labor, new technologies, and some of it is labor-intensive work that could keep a lot of relatively low-skilled people employed happily for a long time. We need to work out the mechanisms to bring people into employment doing that sort of thing.
Alice Rivlin, we've got an email from Randy who writes, government cannot create jobs. Government does not produce a good or service that can be marketed to the rest of the world for a profit, and therefore it does not have the ability to create economic growth. Private citizens and companies produce economic growth and must be allowed to do that in the most efficient ways possible. Is there a consensus on how effective the government can actually be when it comes to job creation?
I agree with the caller that what the objective now is to get the private sector energized and creating more jobs. I believe the government can help. It can help by supporting the incomes of people who spend money and create demand for that private sector, and by making it giving incentives to invest in things like new technology, some of the things that Jamie Galbraith mentioned. But the caller's right. It's the private sector that's got to do this, and we've fallen far behind.
All right, let's go to Alex. She's calling. Actually, I don't know if it's the she or he. Calling us from Olympia, Washington. Alex, hi. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. My question was, I've heard that the collateral on all of our national debt is public lands, and I was just wondering whether that's true.
All right, Alex, thanks very much.
No, it's not true. The government will pay interest on its public debt by typing numbers into a computer, and it can do that indefinitely. But to come back to Alice's point about the private sector, I fully agree. But here the challenge for us is to restore a financial system which is functioning effectively and that can finance private sector activity. And there are two problems here. One is that we have not reformed the banks. We have not really gone in and dealt with the toxic assets which are on their books. And secondly, the finances of the household sector are in terrible condition. And it's probably the more serious problem, the collapse of the value of people's homes, which prevents them from using those homes as collateral for private loans. And until those problems are dealt with, it's going to be very difficult for the private sector to play the role that it should be playing in promoting and supporting economic growth.
Kevin Hassett.
Yeah, I think that the private sector is ultimately going to be where the jobs are created, and that the government can create a better environment for the private sector to prosper by resolving a lot of the uncertainty about what government's going to do. And that's why I think that Alice's effort to have a debt reduction, a bipartisan debt reduction plan that's ultimately accepted by Congress is a big part of the picture. If you think that taxes are going up in a year or two and potentially by a lot, we're talking trillion-dollar deficits. The tax increase is kind of unknowable. It adds a huge amount of uncertainty, makes it so that people might want to locate their plant offshore instead of here in the U.S. And while that's going on, people like our caller from Northfield, Ohio, are wondering where are the jobs? So we have to get our house in order so that the uncertainty about what we're going to do to get our house in order is resolved. And it doesn't mean we have to reduce things this year, but we have to show the American public and American businessmen the plan that lays it all out in a way that as Jamie said, there'll still be deficits. It's just that they won't be skyrocketing off into infinity.
We've been talking for about 45 minutes about basically the agenda for the next year for Washington and what we'll hear from President Obama tomorrow night. And we have not said the words health care reform, which was the centerpiece for President Obama, much of what President Obama pursued and what Congress talked about over the past year. Alice Rivlin, what are the implications for the effort to pass a big health care bill from the concerns we're talking about now about the economy, joblessness, the deficit, and the debt?
I think the administration did the right thing in trying to pass a health care bill. They ran into a lot of opposition and a lot of confusion, and they didn't sell it terribly well. Right now, there are two bills. The only thing that would move it ahead, I think, is if the House were to pass the Senate bill, which is a pretty good bill and which reduces the deficit in the long run. Not very much, but it's helpful on that front, and it would get more people covered by insurance and have insurance market reforms, like people wouldn't lose their insurance because they got sick. So it's basically a good bill. It's not perfect, but I wish they would do that.
But James Galbraith, I wonder, does this focus that we see with the public, too, on the unemployment rate, on deficit spending, does it make it easier or does it make it harder for the health care bill or a health care bill to get kind of over the finish line?
Well, I think we've seen in the painful process of crafting a health care bill just how unwilling, in particular, the congressional Republicans have been to play ball. And it's also true that there is a margin in the Democratic Party, which is a great deal of difficulty making commitments that need to be made to get an effective health care bill. I think probably Alice is right. The House passed the Senate bill. We got this thing done. That would be a step in the right direction. But it's a step that is coming at an enormous political cost, as the Massachusetts results, the Senate result demonstrates. And I think in some ways the exercise will go down as it did with the Clinton administration as a defining defeat for the administration on political grounds.
That was, of course, a very damaging defeat for the Clinton administration. Do you see it that way, Kevin? Do you think that they're likely to not be able to, in the end, get a big health care bill?
I think that the path that could potentially produce a bill out of what we have right now would be the House passing the Senate bill as is. I know that the House folks have a lot of questions about specific items in the Senate bill, but you could sign an oath in blood if you were a Senate leader that you would subsequently pass a corrections bill in the reconciliation process, which would not be something that you could filibuster. You could pass it with 50 votes. If that corrections bill were crafted and shown perhaps in behind closed doors to House people before they passed the Senate bill, then they'd really be agreeing to two bills. And that would be a way in the current legislative process to get to a final law. I think, though, that this bill has been so unpopular that a lot of politicians think that if it looks like they're playing tricks to make it law, then they're going to be run out of town, as happened in Massachusetts.
Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to go back to the phones. We've been talking about the big impact that Massachusetts had, the Massachusetts special Senate election on everything in town. Let's go to Massachusetts and talk to Laura. Hi, Laura. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, hi. Well, I just wanted to make a simple comment and see what your what you have to rebut this. Basically, all I've been hearing, and this has been time and time again, that there's always seems to be these deficit concerns, you know, when it comes to entitlements. But they never seem, and this is Washington and The Economist, they never seem to seem to say that there's, that they're real concerned about the deficits when it comes to bailouts or tax cuts or defense. So I think it's really a class bias that occurs in Washington and with economists. They can talk billions and trillions of dollars all the time, and there's always this worried attitude about the entitlements. Oh, we're not going to have the money for the entitlements, but there's always the money for everything else. So what does your panel have to say about that? Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, Laura, thanks for your call. Alice Riblin, do you want to respond first, and then we'll give Professor Galbraith a chance.
Well, I think the caller's right that as you look at what are the solutions to the looming deficits, everything has got to be on the table, including taxes, including defense, including discretionary spending. Being worried about the future of entitlements is not necessarily a bias against low-income people. All kinds of upper-income people who don't really need it get Medicare, for instance. If we were to charge higher-income people a little more for their Medicare, it would help solve the problem.
James Galbraith, we've getting a lot of emails from people who say, well, you're talking about the deficit, but you're not talking about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and isn't that contributing to our deficit problems? What would you say to that, those emailers, and also to Laura?
Laura stated a very plain truth. Much of the motivation, in my view, behind the talk of deficit reduction is a euphemistic way of talking about a longstanding agenda of reducing Social Security and cutting back Medicare. The same people who are pressing this agenda simply are not giving the same emphasis to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, to military spending generally, to the tax structure, or to other measures. So I think the point is exactly right. This really is a way of bringing cuts in Social Security and Medicare forward on the agenda in a way that would not survive scrutiny in the Congress.
Kevin Hess, we're almost out of time. Let's give you the last word.
Well, I just wanted to defend Alice a little bit in the sense that I think that there are ways to change entitlements that increase the taxes and reduce the benefits or the premium on the wealthy in a way that doesn't change the social safety net and restores fiscal balance. And if we do that, then we'll have more money for other things that aren't necessarily entitlements, like providing education to our children and so on. But if we don't do that, then entitlements grow to be humongous, bigger than the rest of government. And so we've got to do something about them or we're not going to make any progress.
Kevin Hassett, James Galbraith, and Alice Riblin, thank you so much for joining us this hour on The Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.